You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 9th to the 15th of January 2014. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter David Matthews, writer Matthew Rice and books editor Karen Shook. The link between high student dropout rates and the number of undergraduates from low socioeconomic backgrounds has been laid bare in new research, but which institutions book the trend? We'll find out in a moment. Have you ever been frustrated that you can't get your book published because its topic is too obscure or too radical or perhaps just not quite what publishers are looking for? We have a feature this week on the hardcore group of academics who run their own publishing houses in order to get around those issues. And finally, our weekly book section is always filled to the brim with an eclectic range of titles that did manage to get published. We'll hear what's covered this week. But David, let's start with you. You've got the lead news story this week and it's all about dropouts. Tell me more.
Yes, that's right. So we got some very interesting research done by York St John University, which they kindly passed on to us. And basically what it does, it plots the proportion of students at each university in England and the amount of students who have come from families where they have a sort of below average socioeconomic background by certain measures. And then it also, on the other axis, is the number who drop out after the first year. And there's a slightly depressing correlation between the two. So there's a sort of line that goes up, from the bottom left-hand corner and sort of tails off towards the other end. You probably have to see it to make more sense of it. But it basically shows that there's a fairly strong link and correlation between the two. And we've spoken to various people in the sector, Les Ebden, director of the Office for Fair Access, and saying that, you know, this is could potentially be a sort of financial disincentive to universities and institutions to take poorer students, and you know, do they get enough compensation for when students drop out? I mean, because when a student drops out, you lose potentially tens of thousands of pounds in tuition fees, accommodation fees as well, and if they're doing higher cost subjects, teaching grant goes as well. And you look at the what's on offer to compensate for that, and HEFCE have this fund, used to be called the Widening Participation Premium, now called the Student Opportunity Allocation, and it does distribute money, but you know, not nearly as much as to compensate for the loss of money when students do drop out.
No, not much to compensate the students either, I would have thought. I think it's one of the worst things you can do in the UK, isn't it, is to go to university and not actually complete your studies, because you don't get any degree of partial credit, really, do you? You're just sort of regarded as a dropout. You don't have much you can put on your CV.
The transfer credits doesn't operate here the way it does in North America.
Exactly.
You've got nothing, yeah. Except a debt.
Except an impressive-looking debt.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, this is a big issue, not just for university finance, but you know, for the students themselves. But it does show that actually some universities do way better than others. I mean, there are, for example, you've got City University, which has a dropout rate of over 12%. Way over on the sort of the bad end of the graph for dropout rates. But then you've got Oxford Brookes, which has pretty similar numbers of students from disadvantaged backgrounds, actually slightly lower entrance grades, and yet it has below average dropout rate. So you can see that, and you can see the full graph and find out where your university is online on our site.
I suppose it's a matter of universities figuring out how to deal with these students, isn't it? I mean, I've written a bit about big data in the past, and that's one approach taken. You know, whenever students touch into libraries, what are they doing? Where they go to different parts of the universities, can you derive from that activity whether they're at risk of leaving? How often they interact with different university services? I suppose some places do it well, don't they? But others perhaps not so well.
I guess that, I suppose it all comes down to, you know, what things can universities control and what things can't they control. I mean, if you're in London, I mean, I don't know whether that's a particularly inhospitable and expensive environment for a student to be. There's not much you can do about it. Similarly with entrance grades, I mean, if you have lower entrance grades, you're likely to get people who aren't quite as academically strong as others, perhaps more likely to drop out, but they're also more likely to be from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. So that's automatically going to have a correlation. Whereas other factors you can do things about, of course. And you know, this graph it's not supposed to be a sort of council of despair, because it shows actually there is massive room for improvement without dropping your widening participation intake.
Yeah, your sentences there, they relate to before the students have joined the university, don't they? They're sort of lowering entrance grades, or you know, how deep do you dig when making offers? Whereas surely the way that you tackle this is how you deal with the students once they are through the door.
Pastoral care, retention, and so on. Mm. I think this needs to be seen in the context as well of how much lower dropout rates are in the UK than many other countries, mm-hmm. the United States and Canada in particular. So if you accept the argument that changes in the landscape here will mean a sector that is more like North America, this is a problem that's only going to get larger.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there are certain things that have proven to be useful in North America, but this is a wave that is not necessarily going to get smaller.
Could you argue it the other way and say higher tuition fees mean students think a bit more carefully before going to and then leaving university when they've got that? I mean, I suppose we don't know what the data is going to be yet, but I don't know, there could be other forces in the other direction.
So many things that show that students don't think about the fees and that loans are an issue. Of course, there are huge amounts of loans and you know, there's data that shows that lower socioeconomic group students in the United States end up paying more sometimes than others and have huge debts, and it doesn't seem to be a disincentive there either. They're more at risk of dropping out because of part-time work or full-time work.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what the dropout data does over the next few years, but hopefully we'll do a repeat of this graph at some point.
Yeah, no, and it'll certainly stimulate lots of discussion online as well, I'm sure. Moving on, though, our cover feature this week is penned by Ruth Barkin, who's senior lecturer in the Department of Gender and Cultural Studies at the University of Sydney. She discusses, among other things, what she calls feelings of fraudulence, defined as being of the belief that you're not up to the job you've been given, perhaps have somehow been employed in error, a feeling she says is commonplace among academics. So that's certainly worth a read. But our second feature this week is penned by you, Matthew, and it concerns publishing.
Yes, well, this is about academics who have set up their own private presses, small publishing houses, mainly their one-person bands, essentially, though they may have one or two assistants. And there are all sorts of reasons they do this. The one reason they don't do it, of course, is to try and make money, because none of them are making any money. And some of them are doing it as a kind of hobby, using the most old-fashioned kind of printing equipment and getting their fingers inky in the garden shed.
Yeah, there's a wonderful picture I noticed at the beginning of the feature, yes, which illustrates that point.
Yes, Chip Coakley with some beautiful old typefaces. Others do it because they want to publish books which they think are unlikely to be published elsewhere. I mean, for example, it's very hard for commercial publishers to publish short stories because they're generally perceived as not selling well. So one guy I spoke to has published a series of rather spooky single short stories in sort of pamphlet form. There's somebody else who believes that many professional illustrators long to have the opportunity to write their own texts and illustrate them. And so he's set up a press which is solely devoted to what he calls authorial illustration. There's somebody else who's very involved with the asylum seekers in Swansea, and he publishes books partly to raise money for this cause, it's essentially a charitable press, but also to publish asylum seekers and refugees who often find it very hard to get published elsewhere. So they represent different philosophies of life, different desire to publish content, and indeed books designed in rather different ways from what you would find in the mainstream, whether politically or whatever. So there's a variety of very photogenic and intriguing books flagged up here by some it's very hard work running your own publishing, and obviously the ones who do it in the most sort of artisanal way and actually typeset every letter by hand, that is the most horrendously time-consuming way of doing things. But
I can sort of understand it from that perspective, the sort of using the historical techniques is probably quite a hobbyist thing to do, and I can see the appeal there. But I mean, the rest of it seems a bit unusual. Maybe there's not long for this world even, because it's so easy to publish online these days. If I wanted to publish a book on anything, I could simply self-publish it by any number of online, you know, service providers that wouldn't charge you for it. They just take a cut of whatever you end up selling, if anything. So, you know, it seems quite a convoluted way of getting self-published when there's so many easier ways of doing it.
Well, I mean, one of the people said, you know, that the there are no restrictions on your creativity except the ones you impose on yourself. I mean, he works digitally, and he will, you know, change the exact colour of the typefaces and the exact number and style of the typefaces until he's absolutely happy with it. So it's one of the appeals is you have a complete and total control of the production, and you're never going to employ anyone to do it as you know, with as much love and passion as you would do it yourself.
Indeed. Well, that's published this week. It's on page 42, I think, this week. I'm sure you'll find it in this week's edition. But third on the agenda today, one of the most read articles of last month featured scholars and senior features choosing their favourite books of 2013. That's still up online, getting clicks, so do take a look at that. But Karen, there's a new issue out this week, which means a new 2014 books section. What can we expect this week?
Well, in an eerie coincidence with Matthew's piece, we have reviewed one of the books from one of the presses he has covered in that feature.
That's not like that was planning.
It was departmental planning. It was brilliant. Thank you, Matthew.
We must talk to each other occasionally.
A book from Hafan Books, Fragments, Transcribing the Holocaust. This is a fascinating cross-disciplinary effort. Accounts of the Holocaust by three Holocaust survivors, and this book was worked on by an academic who is a professor of qualitative health research. So our reviewer, Robert Eaglestone, who is deputy director of the Holocaust Research Centre at Royal Holloway, considers that book. Also this week, in an eerie echo of David's piece, again, brilliant echo, Angie Wilson at the University of Manchester reviews a book by Jennifer Silva called Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. It looks at young American working class men and women, 24 to 34, looking at their experiences of being buried in student debt, growing up in homes marked by divorce, violence, drug abuse, and their view of the future, and the fact that many of them are focusing on sort of personal development projects, what you might call the Oprah route to self-improvement, because they may have abandoned hope of improving their situation in other ways. And it's a book that the reviewer finds frustrating in some ways, the issue of whether people should merely be told to snap out of it, or maybe they should be more politically engaged and angry about those situations. Also this week, a very newsworthy fellow, Sir Richard J. Evans, friend to Michael Gove, and apparent radical left-wing distorter of history of the First World War, appears in our pages reviewing a book called Archduke Franz Ferdinand Lives. Now, this isn't one of the lies he's alleged to have put around himself. This is a counterfactual book considering what the world would be like if World War I had not occurred. The author, Richard Ned LeBeau, considers things such as, if there had not been a First World War, Yiddish would have been a major language in Europe, amongst other things. Richard Evans considers the personal motivation behind the writing of this book, the author, the author's family, some of them were killed in the Holocaust. He himself was handed to a French policeman by his mother as she was pushed onto a freight train. And Evans considers whether the desire to look at what the consequences of one change, one fateful moment, Gavrilo Princip not pulling the pistol or at least aiming the other way, has to do with a sort of personal sense of the contingency of history and the impact of it. And of course, Richard Evans is nothing if not a person who has met key figures. He has discussed this matter with Peter von Hohenberg, a grandson of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, on a Danube River steamer.
It's a good interview to get, a very good interview.
Absolutely fantastic.
And I've pitched for that interview many times.
He doesn't want to know. Also this week, our book of the week, I'm very excited about it. It's a book that has attracted a lot of attention in the US, where it was published a little earlier. It's by Joshua Green, who's in the Department of Psychology at Harvard. It's called Moral Tribes: Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. Interestingly, for someone who's looking at tribes, Joshua Green himself has straddled them. He began as an undergraduate in philosophy, and now his work straddles psychology, philosophy, and neuroscience. As an undergraduate, he undertook thought experiments while putting people in a brain scanner so he could see what the neural processes involved in moral judgments are. Our reviewer, Natalie Gold from King's College, says this is a hugely ambitious work, and Green is particularly strong on the psychology of moral judgment. She also points out that his view of tribes may be affected in some way by the fact that he's in the US landscape where, for example, the political system is very clearly divided between two teams, the red and the blue, and that there might possibly have been a different approach or a different view taken by someone working in countries where the political system involves those happy experiments known as coalitions.
Thanks, Karen. Wonderful. It's a bit noisy in this podcast today, you may have noticed. We do record this in the newsroom, so it will from time to time get people passing through, so apologies if that has distracted. That's all for this week. I would like to say one more thing on the row between Michael Gove and Richard Evans. It's in our Week in HE this week, which is on page 4, and it's penned by John Morgan, one of our reporters, who came up with a wonderful line. That row, of course, dragged in a number of people, including Tristram Hunt, Labour's shadow education secretary, and ultimately Boris Johnson, who John Morgan says went bravely over the top in his reaction to Tristram Hunt's comments. Read the comments in full there, but I thought that was a wonderful line. That's all for this week. We are available as ever on timeshighereducation.co.uk via our Twitter account at timeshighered. You'll get us on Google+. You'll find us on Facebook. You'll find us on LinkedIn too. So do get in contact if you have anything you want to say. But that's all for this week's Times Higher Education Issue Review Podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.